During the time that I came up, you know, I graduated from high school in 1970, and by that time, and certainly by 1974, the world that I had found myself in, it was almost a given. I mean, that people would be, you know, vehemently opposed to the Vietnam War, vehemently opposed to all of the misdeeds of government that led to that war, and that this, and one way to express that was through this kind of activism. And really, I was very lucky. I mean, I was a 21, 22-year-old college dropout with no discernible skills and no real job experience. And when the Fellowship of Reconciliation, through really the work of Milton Carr, a longtime volunteer with them, asked me to be their staff person in Spokane, and then having met Frank Costello and others, they asked me to join the staff here at what was becoming the Spokane Peace and Justice Center. It just seemed inevitable to me, and it's only in hindsight that I realized how lucky I was, because I could still be sitting in Woodinville without a job, which is where I was in 1974 after I came back from the Indochina Project, the four-week Indochina Project in Spokane. Sure. And you know, I know that the organization's early priorities are in a six-month report that we prepared and miraculously found all these years later. But I have to confess, at my current advanced age, I only remember parts of what's in there as actually happening. So I'll talk about what I remember. The Fellowship of Reconciliation is a now 100-year-old national and international pacifist organization. For many of its members, it's a religion-based pacifism. For others, probably including me, it's based otherwise, just it's the right thing to do, essentially. And so the FOR began as one of the early opponents of the First World War over 100 years ago now, and it's continued that advocacy all the way through. And it has had, off and on over the years, local affiliates, including the ones here in Spokane and Seattle, and I think even Olympia as well. And so, you know, opposition to the Vietnam War was just ending, not because the opposition changed, but because the war mercifully and ultimately ended. And so in Spokane, we took a lot of our lead from national organizations. The focus, it's a lot harder. This is sort of an irony. It's most easy to be effectively anti-war if there's a horrible war going on. It's harder when it's a little more abstract. We're spending billions of dollars on the military beyond, when we're already at a level where we can annihilate the planet untold times over. We're still spending all this money on the military while, you know, children are starving and people are dying of diseases that are curable just because they can't afford medical care and the like. But that's obviously more abstract than this horrific war that's just spewing out carnage. So one focus of the anti-war effort after the war ended was a missile or weapon system called the B-1 bomber, which I believe would have been stationed at Fairchild Air Force Base. And the campaign against it was, we're already, you know, armed to the teeth and beyond. We don't need this bomber. And if the funds spent on this bomber were spent otherwise, look what we could address and cure in terms of social ills, both in the United States and around the world. And so that became the anti-Vietnam War activity was just ending as the war ended when all of this started at the Spokane Peace and Justice Center, and the anti-war, anti-militarism, you know, pro-good ideas efforts continued with initially the focus on the B-1 bomber. And the third party participant in that was the Jesuit province of the Northwest based in Oregon. This for a Jewish kid from Rhode Island, this was a crash course in Catholicism for me, because I thought it was all one big thing until I got involved in this. I don't remember attending the meetings that were early in the process, partly because it happened, I think some of it before I even got to Spokane, and some of it was underway after I got here, but before I think it was a thought to include me in them. What I do remember is that the group that had worked on this, and the three names that, again, I recall are two Jesuits, Father Frank Costello and Father David Lee, both from Gonzaga, And Jim Daigle, who interestingly is now a lawyer in Seattle, but was, I believe, an undergraduate student at the time at Gonzaga. And the three of them were independent of what I was doing and probably even unaware for a while that I existed, had decided to move forward with the Spokane Peace and Justice Center. They felt it was the right time and the right place and the right thing to do. And the participants that you mentioned were all critical to it. Gonzaga provided the building. And it wasn't just a little shed off the side of a building. It was an entire house that had been an annex to their music building. And I mean, it was the full house, which was amazing. And we didn't realize at the time what a big deal that was. And in hindsight, I don't think the Peace and Justice Center or Pajalas has ever had a facility close to that. I mean, it was an entire building, main floor with big rooms for meetings, two bedrooms that we used as offices, an entire second story that was a big loft for other meetings, and a basement where we had mimeograph machines and all of that. But anyway, they were working with Gonzaga to provide that. They were working with the Jesuit province of Oregon to pay and support a Jesuit volunteer, the Peace and Justice Center's first actual staff person, Joe Albert, who came out here from New Jersey after he graduated college specifically to do that. And then the Catholic Bishop of Spokane, who was providing Bishop Topol at the time, who himself is quite a story, he was providing funds for the operation of the organization. And so that all came together and was, luckily for me, sort of handed to me. Here's the building. We'll let you work here. You can have your own office. We realize that it's probably more than you're entitled to given your minimal accomplishments as a young college dropout, but you're going to get it. It's yours, and go forth. So the real founders of that organization were well underway before I got involved, and I, to this day, owe them a great debt of gratitude. We may have gotten permission from whoever you needed permission from in local government to do it, but we didn't talk to any lawyers, we didn't talk to any insurance agents, we didn't talk to any risk managers, we didn't have anybody sign a waiver. We just said, show up downtown at the federal building, trust us, we know what we're doing. And we had this giant contraption, almost as long as a car, on wheels in the shape of a shark, essentially, or I suppose a plane with a shark's mouth, and it said on it, B-1 bomber, billions for war or children, something like that. And it was on wheels, and we, with several dozen people, dragged it from downtown Spokane to Fairchild Air Force Base. Now, as you walk from downtown Spokane to Fairchild Air Force Base, you get to a spot where you can't walk anymore. There's a freeway. So the Jesuits had a bus. And we have, again, no notion of insurance or any of the grown-up things that would terrify me today. The bus met us and this contraption at the spot where you can't walk anymore, took us on the freeway to where the Longhorn Restaurant is, just at the start of Highway 2, after you get off the freeway, and we walked the rest of the way to Fairchild Air Force Base, chanting and singing and carrying signs and dragging this enormous thing. And then we got there, and at that point, the bus came. This I remember pretty clearly. The bus came, took everybody except the B-1 monster thing back to Gonzaga to have lunch or eat, because it was cold. It was January, and I remember seeing a photograph where we were marching under one of these time and temperature signs, and it said 34 degrees. And again, it never occurred to us that January is not the best time to do this any more than February was a bad time to drive to Olympia. But the bus takes everybody back from Fairchild to Gonzaga for lunch, something warm, except me. I'm standing there in front of Fairchild Air Force Base by myself with this B-1 monster thing, thinking this wasn't so smart either. Obviously, nothing bad happened to me, and I was retrieved, and we got together. But it was successful as these things are measured. There were dozens of participants, which is obviously not enough to shut the government down or get anybody's big-time attention, but to have that many people participate in something that abstract in January, and it wasn't just, you know, the typical, let's march from the federal building around the block and hear some speeches. I mean, people had to make something of a commitment to invest the time and energy and all of that to go out there in the cold. And I think, you know, we had been speaking, you know, every time we would go somewhere and talk to a group about the B-1 bomber, we'd collect names, and this was, you know, decades before email, so we would call and follow up with letters or calls and encourage people to participate in the event. So looking back on it, it was a lot of fun, and I'm glad it was only a lot of fun because things could have gone badly without adult supervision.
I think life as it happened was completely different than how we imagined it. Moving out here with other people to form a community where we thought we'd be marginally active in social justice issues, and we would be busy raising food and raising children, and that was pretty much the extent of it. So when we arrived here and fell in the lap of the Mennonite Fellowship, and that became our lens for many of the things we were doing, we became active in a local amnesty group, which we were quite involved in. And that, in fact, was the beginning of my work on the death penalty here in Spokane because, of course, it was part and parcel of the amnesty group which we had here, but it also had created a great deal of friction within the group because there were people in our group who didn't believe that capital punishment was cruel and unusual punishment, and they didn't believe that amnesty's work should be involved with capital punishment because they assumed that people who were executed were guilty. We became active in that and then did some work with nuclear issues, and that was our first involvement. So when I was starting to think about perhaps going back to work, because I'd been taking care of the kids for a couple of years and I wanted to be someone other than Nathan's mother or Lara's mother, and people knew me as that. That was my whole being and the way I was perceived. So an opportunity came up and I became involved and started working for the then Peace and Justice Center with Nick Kassebaum in 1985. We had worked to bring Daniel Berrigan here shortly after I started that job and had a weekend retreat with him, which we attended. And I was predisposed to the idea of civil disobedience, but after that workshop with Berrigan, I became more convinced than ever that this was something I needed to do because I could no longer say no without saying no with my body. I feel very uncomfortable with being a role model or being seen as a role model or seeing Rusty and me as two people who are at the forefront of what's going on in the social justice community, because it's not us. It's PGEL's members. It's people who are part of this work, who have these understandings, who bring us information, who inform us about things that are going on, which we need to address. And so that, that has very much been my view of it, that it's truly grassroots in that way. it wasn't that we personally decided so much. Capital punishment may be an exemption to that, but that we personally decided that this was what we were going to work on, but that there was a movement for that, and that somehow that needed to be visible in the community, and that someone needed to organize it, and someone needed to write about it, and someone needed to speak about it. So, that really was how it happened.
So when we moved to Spokane, I was not committed to staying in broadcasting. I was just going to see how we could work something out and what we could find. And as it turned out, I was able to get a radio job. And that it was hard because I had done news and sports early on, and I'd done general announcing in Minnesota. So what I was good at was making commercials. So when I applied for a job, I didn't know whether to apply as a news person or as general announcer. And so KXLY decided to take me because they needed a news person. They were going to put their news director at the trial every day for Kevin Coe, whose name wasn't Kevin at the time. But anyway, that was the big news thing going on, and that's probably why I got a job there. So I started out in news, and I just really crossed a lot of lines and everything. Every chance I would get to editorialize, I did. I did an interview with Tom Foley one time, and I kept trying to make him make a statement against U.S. policy in El Salvador. and so ultimately, they decided they would put me on the FM station. They wanted to build up the FM station, and it had a good audience at that time and a rising audience. So that was all right. That way, I felt like I could be on the air just playing the elevator music format, and then getting involved in the Peace and Justice Center, then that became PGEL's, and that kept on. That sort of got me away from news. I couldn't do news anymore because I had no objectivity. Right. We had several things that we thought about and planned to do on a personal level. Nancy got involved early on with PGEL's, and she was actually working there as a volunteer, and she worked there enough so that when there was money, she was on the paid staff, and when there wasn't, she was a volunteer. And so we adopted our second child, our daughter, in 83, and we had moved. We had decided before we knew we were going to get a daughter that we would move to the country. We built a house in Chatteroy area, and so that didn't work out because the school system was totally unready for a black child in kindergarten and first grade. And that might have worked out fine with my daughter, but not with my son. And so we felt like we had to move back into town. And so that opened some opportunities. We moved in with some other people in our church community. So we had a three-family home in Brown's Addition. And that put us in a good situation for so observing social justice needs in the community. And so Nancy wound up working in a couple of other places, at Eastern Washington University for one, and then Kathleen needed somebody to help at Pajow's. She was director for 1 year with Diane Jewick. They were co-directors. And then Diane moved to Seattle, and so I applied for the job of associate director. Well, I applied to be on the staff, and they took me on as associate director. And then after a year, Kathleen was too ill to continue. And so I felt like I was not an organizer. That was my problem, being an organizer, which you are. If you're on the staff of Pajow's, you're an organizer. But I was not an organizer, and I felt like if I could get Nancy to come on as co-director, then that would take care of the organizing. So that happened after just a few months of my having it in my lap for a while. And we had an amazing steering committee at that time, too, which made it possible for things to be held together long enough for Nancy to come on staff. We had an agenda, I suppose. Nancy and I had an agenda which was just to be faithful instead of being successful. And that made it easy for me to step back from the radio work just as I was beginning to make some money in that business. But it also was the kind of thing that we really got caught up in, and it would not have been possible for us to even imagine going up against what has to be considered a conservative underpinning in our Spokane community, the love of the Air Force, the carte blanche for military, the worship of Ronald Reagan, and that sort of thing would not have been possible if we had just come in as outsiders and crusaders for peace. But we were able to get incorporated a little bit into the community and find the strength that was already there. The people who had done their time, some of them as hippies, some of them as war protesters in California or other places where things had been pretty hot and heavy. But there was also the faith community involved in Pajow's, and that mostly, I mean, there were not a lot of Mennonites in the Spokane area anyway, but that was helpful to us, and it made us natural allies of the left-wing Catholic community, because Spokane is a Catholic community, and we just had automatically got involved with a lot of the more radical peace freaks in the Catholic Church. And then there were the atheists and the agnostics who were committed to nonviolence, not just anti-war, but to nonviolence. And that was a huge eye-opener for me, and we were able to relate to that. It was our time in agnosticism, or putting church things on the back burner, was very helpful. We could understand the atheist pacifism point of view, and to this day, we consider so many people in who do not find peace through religion. You've got a fine line between religion and spirituality and that sort of thing, and I know a lot of people whom I consider to be spiritual people who don't want to be called spiritual people in any way, shape, or form. But this is a matter of having a movement that transcends the petty differences that come up so often in religion and denominational type of things. I think it was a movement waiting to explode because there was something there for people who were willing to suspend their admiration for the military mindset that we all inherited from World War II. I think particularly in my generation, people who were born during and after World War II, we were sort of given the mantle. Said, this is your country. You can protect it. You do anything to protect this country, even if it seems ugly at the time. And at the time we arrived in Spokane in 1981, the country had already gone through several catharses, I think, with the shame of Vietnam, and it was still ongoing because we were doing terrible things in Latin America, or certainly supporting them with our money and arms. So there were people who just knew this wasn't right, and they didn't have a place to go. Their church might not have cared or wanted to play it down because this was scary topic. And so it was very fortuitous, I think, for Nancy and me to be going into a situation, well, becoming pacifist, basically. Pacifism was just a scary term for me at the time I moved to Spokane, but I landed in this small community of Mennonites. Pacifism was their tradition. So they never met a war they liked. And I didn't think I was going to fit in on that, but the more I studied it and the more I got to know these people, I realized that I needed to do that. And then I started learning things about that I'd never been taught about resistance to war, the nonviolent resistance to war that's gone on forever. That there have always been people who would not fight. And oddly enough, particularly Christians who would not raise the sword. It was just not what we were taught in the original version of Christianity. So I think we were in a good position to connect some of the dots because it was a learning situation for us. And so that's, I think, it was, if we had not landed in the lap of Mennonites when we moved to Spokane, the Peace and Justice Center probably wouldn't have even been on our radar.
It translates into all these other issues. on which we worked. And the torture is the same. But we have a somewhat interesting connection with Bruce Jessen, because a very good friend of ours who was very involved in Pagels through School of the Americas protests is Mormon and goes to church with Bruce Jessen. And I'd had this discussion with him, with Eric, about what that felt like for him, being part of a church community in which Bruce Jessen was elected the bishop of their stake. And he knew Jessen as an individual, which was, believe it or not, helpful to me in that I think we are all, each of us, capable of doing the most heinous acts, that each of us is capable of torture and that each of us is capable of murder, given the right situation, given the right pressure on us. And I think Mitchell and Jessen were really in that position. I'm not excusing them. I'm just saying I think that's how it happened, that they did use the techniques they were using at the survival school for this really egregious purpose. Was being able to see them as human beings. I mean, they are our fellow citizens, just like people who are on death row. You know, we are brothers and sisters with everybody. And that's, you know, that's where the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane is one tiny portion, but we're all, to use the trite expression, but we're all global citizens. And so we're part and parcel of all of these people, and each of us has good and bad qualities. You know, they come out in different ways, and people cope in different ways. People respond in different ways. And part of that is, you know, we've been fortunate enough to see a different way of responding.
I mean, one person I looked up to really early was my Spanish teacher, Teresa O'Halloran, who was actually a member of Pagels, it turned out, later. She really opened the curtains on the world to me in a lot of ways. I always suspected that there was more out there than football and who was going to win and all that. I was pretty sure about that deep inside, but there was a day in one of our Spanish classes with her where she put her hand in the chalk dust and left this white handprint on the blackboard and said that this is called La Mano Blanca, and in El Salvador this means there are 5 days till the death squad comes for you. And she told us who funded the death squads and how they worked. And I think about her bravery of saying that to a room of 15 and 16-year-old farm kids in Deer Park. I don't know what consequences she ever experienced for that. I hope none. But it was quite the world changer for me, that moment where she kind of put on the map where this other world was and how it connected to where I was sitting there in my seat in Deer Park. And she would give us extra credit on the tests for knowing Daniel Ortega, knowing his role, and being able to talk about some key things around peace and human rights in Central America in particular. She was the advisor of a world awareness group that a couple of us started in Deer Park that did things like raise money to save rainforests, that kind of thing. And she invited one of the daughters of the Orellana family to her home to come talk with us. And the Orellana family were the family that were here in Spokane through the sanctuary movement. They lived in St. Anne's. They were sanctuaries from El Salvador. And this young woman met with us at Mrs. O'Halloran's house and talked with us about what her family had experienced in El Salvador. And it was horrific. And she talked about what they were escaping and why they were here. And it really deeply affected me. I don't think that most people have this early experience of becoming politicized or politically active around international human rights issues. And so it was really transformative for me to, the first thing I ever did was, well, the first thing I ever did was try not to dissect a frog, which was a failed attempt. Don't try to organize an animal rights group at Deer Park High School. I don't think it will work. I tried it. It will not work. Know your base. Know the issues that matter to your base. That's not it. But so the second thing I did was my one friend and I did a fast and held a two-person march around Deer Park High School cafeteria and donated our money toward a resettlement village for Salvadoran refugees in Honduras, and then participated in a walkathon to raise money for that resettlement village. And so Mrs. O'Halloran, and the fact that, you know, she gave us extra credit to go see the movie Romero when the Central America groups brought it to town at the Old Magic Lantern. And the fact that she was really helping me open my eyes to the rest of the world was really, really, you know, fundamentally transformative for me. I was a senior in 1991 when we were about to go to war against Iraq that time. And I was seeing in my high school literally people in the hallway pumping their fist for war. And a kid in my homeroom said we should go kick some Saudi ass, even though we were in alliance, actually, with the Saudis. But it was being treated with the same us versus them thinking that we were trained to think about in terms of whether we thought Deer Park or Riverside should win the football game Friday night. And this really lazy, racist, my country, whoever the other guy is, we're going to beat him kind of thing, was really upsetting to me. It was upsetting to me when it came to football, and it was more upsetting to me when it was being applied to the question of war. And I didn't have any kind of huge analysis around imperialism or militarism or nonviolence or any of those things. I just thought that the question of whether we go to war is serious enough that it deserves some critical thinking, and it deserves some serious engagement, and it shouldn't be this sort of rah-rah, go-team approach to a situation where people are going to die. And so there was no Google, of course, in 1991, and so I looked up peace in the phone book, and there was the Peace and Justice Action League. And I'm so grateful that it wasn't named the Justice and Peace Action League, because I would have never found it, and I don't know what would have become of my life. I don't know where I'd be right now, but there it was, the Peace and Justice Action League. And so I called, and I remember Rusty answering the phone, and I knew his voice because I used to listen to the Sentimental Journey show that he used to do on the radio when my mom and I would cook. And so I recognized his voice, and so I started coming to the Youth for World Awareness Club, driving all the way 45 minutes to sort of exotic cosmopolitan downtown Spokane, and participating in these club meetings. And it was really an oasis for me of critical thinking and of people actually encouraging each other to ask questions and taking each other seriously, and young people being taken seriously by adults who we really respected. Mary Pat Truthart was the advisor for the youth group at the time, and, you know, She was a bit of an idol for me, honestly, with her sort of jet black page boy and her red lipstick and her accent, and, you know, just it was quite an exposure to me. And we took on small, what now in retrospect seem like small projects that were not small at all at the time, like organizing a benefit concert or just doing the basics of figuring out how to take action together. And so that's how I got involved with Pajals way back in 1991. The roots of the Young Activist Leaders Program are in the same program that I started with. It's a relaunch of that program. For a couple of years before we relaunched it, we hosted internships through the School of Social Work at Eastern. And so Char Lichty, who's our organizer now, came in as an intern in the fall of 2009 through the BSW program, along with Erica Scott, another really fantastic young organizer. And the next year we hosted Justin and John, two great folks through that internship program as well. And then the next year we realized that we needed to be giving more support to folks who were coming through as interns, and that if we're going to be doing workshops for interns, we may as well be doing workshops for a larger group of people. And so we asked in May of 2011, we asked members to step up with financial support so that we could expand our staffing and so that we could relaunch this youth program with that expanded staffing. And there was an absolute resounding yes to that idea. There's a real commitment to supporting young people as leaders, and there's a real shared concern about how the work of social justice and peace will be done if we're not engaging young people. It's not going to happen. So in the fall of 2011, we restarted our youth program as the Young Activist Leaders Program. And it's a cohort-based, nine-month leadership development program supporting youth, two goals, supporting youth as leaders right now, today, around whatever social justice issues their passion moves them to work on, not waiting for some kind of mythical tomorrow where the rest of us all suddenly step aside, but actually supporting youth as leaders right now. And the second goal is to increase youth engagement in PGALS and youth leadership in PGALS so that we are supporting and building an intergenerational movement that can benefit from the fresh ideas of new activists and the energy and the insight and the holistic analysis that young people are bringing, and can also benefit from the long-term use of that holistic insight that more experienced activists and organizers also bring. So we're really working to build an intergenerational movement that invites everyone in and has room for people of all ages to respect each other as leaders and as activists. So we restarted that program. We graduated in June, our fifth class of the Young Activist Leaders Program. And it's probably the thing that I'm most proud of that we do. It's the least easy to quantify in the short term, but it's the absolute most important in the long term. We can't have a movement that doesn't bring in new people. And we need to bring in new people of all ages, but in particular, we want to bring in youth. And it's been really powerful for me to work with the young folks that are drawn into that campaign and into that program. They really do bring this very holistic perspective that this idea of intersectionality is like air. It's present. It's easy to understand. Yeah, racism is a system that's unacceptable. Sexism is a system that's unacceptable. Class exploitation is unacceptable. And the exploitation of the earth is unacceptable. There is no separation. We don't have to have a big conversation about how to understand how these issues are interconnected. No, we got it. We see. It's all screwed up. It's a very holistic, it's all screwed up sort of a banner. And what we spend a lot of time on is the organizing skills to begin to take apart. Yeah, it's all screwed up. Where are we going to start? What are the things that we're going to do, and how are we going to work on those things in ways that acknowledge all those interconnections, but that actually can start to make some kind of a dent? Because I was trained as an organizer that hope is absolutely critical. As Harvey Milk said, you got to give them hope. Well, hope comes from a plan to win. Hope comes from a plan that is clear and credible and achievable. And activists sometimes fail at that piece of our work. We have to be hopeful ourselves in order to move other people through hope.
Probably 17, 18 when I found PGALS. If I was 18, I think I was 18, It was kind of during a period of, like, right after a period of sort of brief homelessness, of couch surfing. And I just found out I was getting, like, a scholarship to college to finish out my last 2 years at Eastern. So my life was kind of going from, like, down here to, like, suddenly there was all this hope. And that's when I found Pajels, and I was involved in a lot of student clubs at Eastern, like the Scary Feminists, which that was their actual name, and I think it still is their actual name, and then the Pride Group there, and then Young Activist Leaders Program was revived, I believe, when I was 18, maybe when I was 19, and I was invited, I think, by Taylor Weech. And I looked into the program, and it just sounded really cool. And so that was kind of how I found PGELS, was largely through the Young Activist Leaders Program, but also any protest that was happening downtown ever was usually sponsored by PGELS. So I also remember that they were, I believe they were a part of peacekeeping and stuff when the Westboro Baptist Church came and protested in Spokane. And that was just really cool to see a local organization that was largely they targeted places where youth were, high schools and colleges. That was cool to see an organization stand up for youth and LGBT youth very publicly. So for me, I think I was starting to get really fired up, and I had all this energy and had no idea what I was doing. And with student organizing, especially, you just find yourself reinventing the wheel over and over and over again. And you're just starting to learn how to communicate with leaders. And that was, I think, definitely a huge part of what, Pajels gave me. Like, I had done some stuff with Planned Parenthood in terms of going to lobby day and things, but that was just reproductive rights, and Pajels opened my eyes to this whole other world. People of all ages, like really, really all ages, just as many people in their teens as people in their 80s, people from all economic backgrounds, and everyone is just like fired up. It's as if being jaded was never a thing, despite the fact that I think Pajels is a really smart organization in terms of how they go after issues, how they tackle issues, and how they think about how to communicate with leaders. Like, they're very strategic, and yet they have all their optimism still. So they've managed to not buy into the fact that the battle that we're fighting is futile, which is really cool. So you just walk into this room full of energy, and this room full of this collective feeling of wanting to get together and make change, and there's a lot of mutual respect and wanting to learn from each other. For me, I connected to Pajels through Liz Moore, and she was just from the get-go just so 100% like accepting of me, and there was like no question that I would be respected and treated like a human. Oh my God, I'm like, got me choked up for a second. And especially when I was a teenager, sometimes that was rare from adults. And I grew up on the South Hill, which is actually, it's kind of like a weird conservative little pod in Spokane as opposed to downtown. So for me, it was clear from the beginning that the leadership of the organization, like, cared about me as a person and wanted to respect me as a person. And then when I was in the Young Activist Leaders Program, like Liz really centered on, we want to help you accomplish what you're already accomplishing, because we believe that youth are already doing the work. Like, this isn't about the children are our future. Like, the children are doing work right now. Like, you know, trying to change cultures in our school. And so there was just this this commitment from the beginning to learn from us, which I think is very unique in a nonprofit, actually wanting to learn from the communities that you're trying to support. And that's a big deal.
I might just say one more thing.
Please.
I just want to give my love to the people who have sustained this organization for such a long time. It is not common for a place like Spokane, Washington, to have a 40-year-old peace and justice group, and that is such a testament to Ken Isserlis and to Father Frank Costello and to Nick Kassebaum, who I've never met, and to Kathleen Donahoe and to Nancy and Rusty and to Heidi Burbage and to all the other people that worked at Pajals over the years and who have been part of the steering committee of Pajals over the years. We always say it's not because there has been, generous corporate sponsorship of Pajals by any means, ever. And it's not even because there has been sustained support from the foundation world. The foundation world is very up and down, very trend focused. It's really because regular people in Spokane have decided that this organization is here to stay, and that we're gonna take on issues that nobody else will take on. We're gonna challenge ourselves to build broad coalitions and be steadfast.